Hi, this is Bill Indicke for the Streets.mn podcast, conversations about transportation, public space, and urban design in the Twin Cities. This week's podcast is a conversation with Ken Bradley, who is running for Minneapolis City Council in Ward 10. Ken is a longtime environmental activist and organizer, and his resume is a who's who of Minnesota's environmental organizations, including the Sierra Club, the Minnesota Environmental Partnership, and Fresh Energy. His campaign platform for Ward 10, which runs from southeast of Lake Calhoun all the way up to the Whittier neighborhood, emphasizes sustainable energy, environmental development, and alternative transportation. Ken and I sat down last week in his home in the Uptown neighborhood to talk about his ideas for Minneapolis, the definition of sustainable development, and the frustrating challenges of taking the bus from Uptown. We even ended by exchanging our favorite transit jokes. So I hope you enjoy our conversation. Also, before I forget, please consider a donation to the Streets.mn PayPal button on our website. We're trying to raise a little bit of money to cover our costs, and currently, all those are being funded by donations from our volunteer writers, including me. So every little bit helps out, and we really appreciate it. Okay, great. Well, welcome to the podcast. I'm here with Ken Bradley, who is running for city council in Minneapolis, Ward 10. And Ken, you have a background in energy issues. Do you want to tell us about that and why Sure. you decided to run for city council?
Well, I guess my short bio is I've lived in Minneapolis for nearly 30 years. I'm an energy and environmental advocate or activist by trade and organizer. And in my personal time, I'm also an advocate for providing financial assistance for students in need. I serve on a foundation board that does that type of work. And I'm run to provide fair, open, progressive leadership. And I think of myself as a progressive first and a Democrat second. And for me, what that means is that, you know, if you're progressive, you're thinking about the underrepresented or who's not at the table, not just those who have the resources to be at the table.
Uh-huh. So why did you decide to get involved in this race here in Ward 10? And let's just describe what Ward 10 is for a second, right? So yep. Where are the boundaries? Because they just reshifted all these boundaries, right?
Yeah, so if you're not in Ward 10 or in the city, it may be confusing and hard for me to explain exactly. But it's essentially the neighborhoods of East Harriet Farmstead, which is a neighborhood to the south of my own neighborhood, which is the Carrig neighborhood. And then there's the Echo neighborhood, which is East Calhoun, which borders Lake Calhoun. And then the Wedge, which is also called Lowry Hill East Neighborhood Association. And then the new part of the ward is Whittier, mm-hmm. which is I'm very excited that Whittier is a part of the ward. When I was a kid, I spent a lot of time in Whittier. I went to church in Whittier. My dad lived in the edge of Whittier when I was a kid, so I spent a lot of time there as well. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's kind of this like swath from, you know, all like Lake Calhoun and kind of even south of Lake Street down where we are now. All the way up to Franklin Avenue, up by the Art Institute.
Yeah. I'd say, where I'm kind of in the panhandle of the 10.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at it on a map geographically, I say it's kind of like Texas.
Yeah.
It's a little bit shaped almost in a weird way, kind of like Texas. And I'm up in the panhandle.
So would your motto be Ward 10, Texas of Minneapolis?
Yeah, we could be.
No, I don't like it.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Too many bad connotations. Great. Well, so you're running for city council. What made you do that?
Well, you know, for me, it was really a process. I first had friends and neighbors and business people and other leaders in the community that came to me and encouraged me to run. And I've actually been involved in electoral politics in my life. I worked for the Democratic Party. I worked on R.T. Ryback's very first campaign in 2001. And I've worked on various of their campaigns over the years. And I've probably spent as much time trying to talk people out of running for office than talking them into it. So people that have come to me, I would say, you know, why do you want to do this? And so when people first approached me about running, I was somewhat skeptical of it, but thought, well, I'm going to go out and talk to people and just kind of get a better feel. So I went and talked to what I felt were some kind of objective folks I knew in the community. I asked them their opinion about if I should run, if they thought that my type of leadership would be the good, you know, what the city could use, and to feel free to tell me that it's not. I told them, don't be afraid to tell me I'm not the right person. I won't be offended in any way. And I got very strong support from people who I have a lot of respect for, both who work in city government and you know, other folks that I think are really connected to the city of Minneapolis. So then I probably spent several more months kind of still stewing on it, and my wife, Crystal, kept bugging me to say, what's keeping you from making a decision? And I told her, well, to be honest, I don't think that she really understood what she was getting involved in.
Oh, yeah.
And for me to run for city council would be, you know, a big challenge on her, on her family, and the fact that, you know, I would ask a lot of her to do that.
Well, you'd have annoying gadfly reporters knocking on your door every day, and that, even on a 4 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon.
Yeah, I think that I don't know if that would bother as much the fact that, you know, really I kind of said I would be somewhat absent in her life in the sense that I would ask her to do a lot for me, and then I would be totally focused on running for office, which, as I said, seems a bit self-absorbed, because I think it has to be to kind of win. That's kind of the way you have to be. And I wasn't completely sure she signed up for that when we got married. And she said, you know what, I think you'll be a great city council member. And she urged me to run. And after, you know, pretty long conversation with her, I felt confident about doing it.
What are your main issues then?
Well, so, you know, I think that the greatest debt that my generation, and I'm 47 years old, and really the generations before me are leaving future generations, is climate change. I don't think there's a greater debt being left. If you look at, you know, 12 of the last 15 years have been the hottest on record. I don't think it's going to get better. I started working on energy and climate issues over, you know, 12 years ago, and at that time, I was very hopeful that we were going to make progress in 2, 3, 4, 5 years, and it's 12 years later. And we need to solve this problem at the local, state, federal level with individuals and businesses all engaged. And I don't see our city moving fast enough. There's some great people in the city doing good work, but we need to be moving much faster. And we need the political leadership to do that. And I believe not only we can move faster, but at the same point in time, we can make Minneapolis an international leader at showing how municipal governments and municipalities reduce climate emissions and create new jobs from emerging industries and businesses in our city. And so I think it's not a problem, it's an opportunity. And under that, I really have five main pieces I'm running on, which I could keep talking, but I don't know.
Well, I want to follow up on one question, which is about what I think about climate change. I mean, it's really a global issue, right? So you have these conferences. The last one was there was Copenhagen, and there was another one somewhere, Doha, right? Is that right? It doesn't matter. There's a lot of them. They happen every year, it seems like. And they're always disastrous, right, where nobody can agree on anything and nothing really happens. And you know, so my point is that climate change seems to be like a really global issue, or at the very least it needs to be addressed at the federal level. What can a city do in a climate change context? And what can someone like Minneapolis do?
I think it's a great question, but the fact is that I actually believe if we act locally, we will impact globally on this issue. I think if we can show small models of success, municipal locations making progress on climate change, that'll inspire other places. I'll give you a great example where it's happening right now. Boulder, Colorado did a very unusual thing. They voted to pursue municipalization and get rid of Xcel Energy, who's their utility.
Mm-hmm. I just read about this yesterday on the internet.
And they have been doing their analysis for the last couple of years to see if they could do that. What the voters told them they could do is, you can do this, but it needs to be as cheap as Xcel Energy's current power or cheaper. It needs to be, you know, cleaner and provide more renewables. And if you can't do it for that, you need to stick with Xcel. They came back, and their initial analysis shows, yes, they can do it cheaper. B, they can do it, I think, by reducing the emissions, I want to say immediately, I believe it was by 50 or 54%, because there was 250 numbers. And they can increase, I think it's they can reduce their emissions by 54%, increase their renewables by 50% immediately, and do it cheaper. So we know that it can happen, but in Boulder, they've taken that leadership, They're taking those steps, but it's going to take people who are, you know, bold, strong, and willing to stand up to kind of powerful interests to move forward. And what often happens, whether it be the state, local, or federal government, is we will give a very small piece of, you know, the pie to look at, to kind of partially solve the problem, but we're not really taking on big chunks. And I think that that's what we can do at the city of Minneapolis. And by doing that, so what Boulder did has actually inspired Minneapolis, now has its own campaign, what's called Minneapolis Energy Options, which is looking to do that exact same thing here in Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. So that's where I say is, they did something in Boulder, it inspired Minneapolis. Minneapolis is now doing Minneapolis Energy Options campaign, which you can go to MinneapolisEnergyOptions.com to see more about that campaign. And we could do that in Minneapolis on a variety of different fronts, which will inspire other cities and other folks to do good things.
So what, like what fronts? What are we talking about? Give me another couple examples. That's a really intriguing example.
So let me give you, I'm going to give you the bare bones version, because I would rather give you the bare bones version of my five priorities than let you ask questions.
Let's do it.
My first is to ensure development reflects the character of our neighborhood. My second is to support emerging businesses, entrepreneurs, and industries. My third is to build inclusive government through partnerships and community collaboration. And I know that sounds vague, but there's meat to that those bones. My fourth is to support alternative transportation and development that is pedestrian and bicycle friendly. And my fifth is to reduce our dependency on polluting energy by supporting energy efficiency and local renewables. And there's more content to all that than the bullet points. And obviously there's other issues that are important and a priority for our city, but those would be the five pieces I would focus on as my own priorities during my first term.
Well, let's how would those things help tackle climate change? Like what's the connection between CO2 emissions and cities? How we design Minneapolis, mm-hmm. what Minneapolis has, how's Minneapolis affected the atmosphere, you know?
Well, so one scary thing is that Xcel Energy's emissions, actually the intensity of it, actually went up last year. It's a really strange thing.
What do you mean by intensity?
Well, the intensity, the amount of carbon emissions.
Okay, carbon intensity.
Their carbon intensity, their amount of carbon they release actually went up. And this is according to data they provided to the city of Minneapolis. It went up. Not a huge amount, but it went up. Strangely enough, across the United States at the same time, emissions were going down. Some of that's due to more natural gas being brought into the system. Some of that is because of the economy, and you know that we're in a downturn. We've been in a downturn, but I think there was a 20% reduction in emissions that the data showed over the whole U.S. Actually, had a reduction in the U.S., but our emissions went up. So one is, I think we need to actually do directly believe we need to take on Xcel Energy. There's a franchise agreement coming up. There's an opportunity right now. Every 20 years, Minneapolis signs franchise agreements with our municipal utilities. Every city does this in all of Minnesota that doesn't have a municipal utility or a co-op. And these agreements are 20-year agreements. I don't think Minneapolis should sign that without a guarantee from Xcel Energy they're going to reduce their emissions, increase local renewables and energy efficiency. And if they can't do that, I really believe that the city council should vote to put on the ballot in November an amendment that would allow the voters to do the exact same thing that Boulder residents gave their council the support to do, which is say, hey, if you can do this cheaper, if you can do this as, you know, and produce more renewables and reduce emissions at the pace that we need to do in our city, you have the right to become a municipal utility. And so I think that is one big place that we can do it. On development, buildings are kind of, you think about all of our buildings in our city. New buildings, we shouldn't be building a new building in our city that is not at least Energy Star certified or LEED certified.
Yeah.
And if they're not Energy certified or LEED certified, in my opinion, we shouldn't be building them. We should be thinking about development in new buildings. It shouldn't be, does this just produce tax revenue? Does this help make somebody money? Does this produce, you know, a resident or a business location? Those things are important, but we should also be thinking about is what is the broader community benefit to when we're developing buildings? And if we're not thinking about it from a community benefits focus, then I think that we've kind of lost it. So we shouldn't be building any building that doesn't kind of have the highest energy efficiency standards in our city.
Yeah.
Anything new shouldn't be built.
Okay. Well, so you like the LEED program?
I think that LEED's great. Yeah. And, you know, LEED and Energy Star both kind of have their different strengths and weaknesses.
Uh-huh.
And
I hear a lot of critiques of the LEED program sometimes too, but I think they're moving in the right direction with the inclusion of like neighborhood, neighborhood location factors. So the building isn't treated as an island, you know, as a, like just in the middle of space, but it actually relates to the city in a certain way, and that'll get it some points, I think.
Yeah. No, and I think that, that's the difference between is Energy Star is mostly focused just purely on energy, which is not bad. I'll take that as a, and LEED, I think, looks at a lot of other kind of elements to how does this building impact, or, you know, is it close to transit line?
Right. It, that's the kind of thing that I'm talking about.
Those type of things. So I think that those are additional benefits. The only reason why I think the Energy Star is still okay is, truthfully, I think in Minneapolis, most commercial buildings are close to transit lines. So you get points for that. It might be a good thing, but, you know.
Especially around here in in Uptown. Can we call it Uptown? Is that okay?
Yeah, you can call it Uptown. But it's also, I guess I want to say that if we're going to call it Uptown, we have to make sure that we're not... We're also acknowledging Whittier.
Yeah, okay.
Because I think people...
Ward 10.
Some people in Whittier may consider themselves from Uptown, but...
Oh, I don't think it, not the same at all.
But I think that some would think, you know, we're really Whittier. I mean, Whittier, of the neighborhoods we have, I think that all the neighborhoods have a lot of... people have a strong identity to their neighborhoods in Minneapolis.
Oh, they do, yeah.
But I think that Whittier has one of the strongest, like... you know, self-identifications. I'm from Whittier.
The Eat Street, story of Eat Street is an amazing kind of tale of people just kind of bootstrapping themselves up. You know,
which is
very literal, I don't know, with that campaign is great.
Which is one of the most exciting parts of the ward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, what happens to Nicollet Avenue is probably one of the most exciting reasons I want to be a city council member.
I want to jump back to development for a second, because when I'm thinking of David Owen's book, Green Metropolis. It's it came out a few years ago. It's just about green cities and the connection between sort of our environmental footprint and that, you know, energy use footprint. And that's climate change, right, basically. And being in a city. And he starts it by talking about how the greenest city in the United States is Manhattan. Right, because people's average energy use is so much lower. They're living in smaller places and they're sharing walls with other apartments or whatever, and that's really heat efficient. And then people just don't drive very much in New York City proper, right? Because you don't have to. You can get around in all sorts of ways. So I guess that's my question. So beyond just the building stuff and talking to XL Energy, how do we tackle climate change through some land use and development kind of questions?
Well, I'm going to go one step back to the buildings because I don't want to miss on this, and then I'll go to some of the other pieces on development, I guess, and land use. We talked about new buildings, but I also think it's just as critical for us to reduce our emissions to what we need to do. We have to focus on existing buildings. We can't do it any other way. So we have to look at existing building infrastructure, commercial buildings, multifamily homes, all of that. And so that's got to be part of kind of the comprehensive plan of how do we increase the energy efficiency. There's very few buildings in our city that I think an energy efficient audit and coming in and looking at it would not be able to go with some investments that would pay off very quickly, say, oh, we can reduce emissions by 20% or 40% or 60%.
I know the last two places I've lived in St. Paul have been sieves, you know?
Yeah.
And I did my best to kind of stop the heat from going out, but...
But I think that with some basic, really basic stuff, we can save a lot of money and reduce energy in existing buildings. So we have to do that because we already have a built infrastructure, so we can't ignore that piece. On the other pieces, I think that from a land use, how we use land, we are a society that is, you know, there's no denying it that we are completely built, developed, and focused around the automobile. That's the reality, and that's the way we've been for a long time. And Minneapolis, isn't really, the Twin Cities is much different than Los Angeles in a lot of respects. Our transit system really isn't any better than theirs. I mean, in a lot of respects.
Well,
the
LA transit system is pretty good, actually.
Well, that's what I'm saying. We sometimes think that, but you'll hear people in Minneapolis say, well, yeah, Minneapolis is a pretty good transit system. I go, it's okay. But so the problem we have with our transit system and what we need to do we need to have all the spokes of the wheel completed with our light rail system. But then we really need to build up the backbone, which is our bus system. I think we need to, I'm becoming more and more of a fan of streetcars. I'm worried a little bit about how we pay for streetcars and how those will be paid for. But I think if Governor Dayton is successful at getting an additional sales tax added regionally, we will be able to pay for that type of investment.
Yeah, let's knock on wood for that, huh?
Yeah, no, I'm crossing my fingers. But we need not just to finish the spokes, but then make our existing system faster and more efficient. It's because the reason people don't use public transportation is that they say, well, it's slow. It doesn't get me from point A to point B quicker. And so we need it to move faster. And so I think what we need in Ward 10 is on Nicollet, I think we're going to have streetcars on there. And those streetcars are going to be modern streetcars that are fast, that are efficient, that are going to have the ability to change red lights to green lights to make them so they can go through intersections quicker. They're going to load people in and out faster than buses do. And they're going to get from point A to point B faster than the current 18 does.
And I'll add that I often fight with people over streetcars because some of my colleagues think that they're kind of extravagant expense and buses will do the same thing. But there's a kind of qualitative difference between them too. Like the way that they feel and ride and the experience for everybody is just, it's really different. And the capacity is also larger on a streetcar.
Well, I think probably the bigger challenge for me in streetcar is how do we fund the local cost? I don't think that it should be, I think some people are talking about making special transportation type TIF districts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard that.
I'm not sure that's fair any more than unless we want to start making special transportation TIF districts for highways. I mean, I just don't see that being a fair funding mechanism.
You'd never be able to fund a highway through one of those.
No, you wouldn't. You wouldn't be able to fund a highway by saying, hey, the people that benefit it, whose buildings are on it, should pay for it.
Yeah, like the Stillwater Bridge. Imagine how much tax would go up on the other side of the St. Croix River. Let's not talk about that.
But I think that those examples are like examples of, we don't ask the highway system to do that.
Yeah.
But we're talking about a streetcar in the city. We go, well, and it's not a streetcar. It's a modern streetcar. And I think that's clear to make is that don't think about this as the streetcar that's riding down at Lake Harriet on the weekends.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
No, or the ones we see at the state, or the ones we see at in San Francisco, in Rice-A-Roni commercials. It's not those type of streetcars.
No, it's like Toronto, if you've ever been to Toronto.
Yeah, they're fast, they're efficient, they're really quick. And so how we fund it, I guess, is the one thing I'd be concerned about, but I think we can figure out a good way to do that. The other piece is that when we do it, we can't lose the character of Nicollet in the process of it. I will tell you, one of the greatest concerns that people who live in Whittier have, people who live in the Wedge and Carrick have when they think about Lindale Avenue, Lindale and people who love Lindale Avenue and love Nicollet Avenue, their greatest concern is that their streets that have great locally owned restaurants and stores owned by various ethnic groups will end up turning into 30th and Hennepin. So where Calhoun Square is and where we have an Apple store and we have all these other chains and a Victoria's Secret. And hey, I have no issue with Victoria's Secret personally.
Let's not go there either.
Or any of these other things. Like, I don't have any issue with these stores. Or there's a CB2, which is an interesting thing. On the 31st, they actually tore down a three-story historic brick building and built a two-story CB2 suburban style development on it, which actually didn't fit the small area plan for the area. It says in the area that anything built in that corridor should be 3 to 6 stories. They tore down a three-story historic building and built a two-story building that doesn't fit what the density should be for that corner. So as we think about the new transit, we need to do that, but we need to make sure that we retain the character of our neighborhoods and that we're not losing that. And I think that there's some concern about that, especially from the residents in Whittier, in the Wedge, in Carrick, that they don't want to become 50th in France. I mean, 50th in France is fine, but let it be 50th in France. We want to have, mom and pop owned places in our community.
Yeah. Example of Trader Joe's development. Mm-hmm. That block of the currently existing two-story. Yep. I mean, they're not really kept up and nice, but they had an amazing diversity of exactly the kind of small local businesses yep. that you're talking about. There's a laundromat, and there's a really interesting and weird tea supply place.
Mm-hmm. The tea supply place is great.
Yeah, I like it too. And then there, for a long time, was a vacuum supply.
There's a sports place.
And then there's a soccer ball store. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can't think of a more diverse set of businesses than that.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was the Sunnyside Cafe, yeah. which isn't there anymore.
And I truthfully think the Sunnyside Cafe and the laundromat, they're, you know, Sunnyside has not been there for a long time. Yeah. It has been vacant,
yeah.
Which used to be the Egg and I mm-hmm. back in the 80s when, you know, when I was a punker living in Uptown.
Yeah. I'm trying to imagine that. But let's, so in that proposal, and I actually
sympathetic. I had a lot of angst.
Yeah.
I had a lot of angst.
I kind
of
wish I'd been in that Uptown area yeah. in the 80s, you if know, to see what it was like.
You actually couldn't even live in an Uptown and be a 20-something. It actually had to have angst. It was an automatic, like, you have angst? Okay.
You can come in now.
You can come in now and, you know, we'll meet you at the CC Club on Wednesday night.
I watch, like, Purple Rain, you know, and I look at Hennepin Avenue back then and how different it looked. That was interesting. Mm-hmm. But anyway, in this proposal, the building owner, I kind of felt for him because he's an old guy who's been taking care of these buildings, and they're, you know, hard to maintain for a long time. And he was happy to sell them, and, you know, he's kind of reluctant, but he got a good price.
You're talking about Trader Joe's?
Yeah, the guy yeah. who owns the laundromat. And mm-hmm. I just read an interview with him, and then the Trader Joe's proposal came in. And how would you have, like, made that decision? And it's hard to say, I guess.
Well, first, strangely enough, and I've actually will tell you, I've contacted people who've worked with Trader Joe's, and they have not called me back.
Oh, yeah.
Because I've tried to understand it better. And so I'm interested in how the development actually was going to be put together. I would have not supported tearing down those where the tea shop is or those historic buildings. The laundromat and the Sunnyside Up is not, I don't believe those are historic.
And they're one story.
They're one story. I don't think they're historic. So what I wish, I can tell you what I wish would have happened on 31st and on Hennepin. And I think this possibly could happen in a location there, and maybe you could serve the tea shop and keep them available to others. On 31st and Hennepin, what I wish they would have done is what they did on Hennepin Avenue downtown, where they have a Lund's store now.
Mm-hmm.
Lund's took a historic building, they revamped it, revitalized it, and then it didn't fit their floor plan perfectly, so they built out the parts on the back of it. On the front of it, they did additions onto it to make it fit their floor plan. That's kind of what I wish CB2 would have done on the corner of 31st and Hennepin. Keep that three-story brick building, add on, because they like a long floor plan, so add on three stories across, and then, you know, if they needed to pull up the second floor and get rid of the second floor in the building so they have higher ceilings, or what do they need to do, do those things, but integrate the existing historic buildings into that. If they could have maybe done something there, I could see that maybe working. I mean, I know the other issue is always parking, 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 parking. And so
I think you forgot parking.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's yeah. a big
so,
issue
So, I mean,
too.
So it's an issue that I think creates the challenges for those developments is then how do you, you know, I think maybe with those older buildings there, I'm not sure if they could have gotten underground. Like, I think they probably wanted to tear the whole block down and start from scratch. And so I think when we tear down the historic buildings along those corridors, I really do think that we're losing part of our city. That's what we did, a great example of it, that we're still complaining about 40 years later is the Kmart on Nicollet Avenue.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And nobody likes it, and everybody wishes that what was there was back. And I can remember my dad as a kid driving me down Nicollet Avenue and getting to that point and saying, who would ruin this perfectly good road by putting a store in the middle of it? Someone should drive a bulldozer through that store.
You could just say that you were just on autopilot, man. You thought Nicollet Avenue kept going. That bulldozer went right through.
You should go look, but the bridge of old Nicollet Avenue.
I've been there, yeah.
It goes right up to it.
Yep. Mm-hmm. You could drive that thing right
you
in
could.
There.
You
get
could.
Get some momentum going.
You could. So it's, But I think what happens is that when the city stops embracing kind of our quirky, unique, you know, and historic self, and we try to become something different, and I guess different always tends to be people want something new, and I think we can do something new. You can take something historic and revitalize it and repurpose it and make it work in a new way. But I think when we were just tearing, you know, especially unique historic buildings down to accommodate the future, we kind of become a boring place. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, why not move to Eden Prairie? You know, and I mean, why not? There's no difference. Why not move to Eden Prairie where, or move to another suburbs, because there's no reason not to live there, because that's what, they don't have anything historic. So, you know, so what's the purpose of living here?
Mm-hmm. So what would you have, so the Trader Joe's case, yeah. How do you balance development then? And especially the issue of parking, you mentioned parking before. What are your thoughts on how to solve some of the challenges that come with?
The parking's a very difficult one. What we're really dealing with is the issue of kind of two clashing generations, I think, right now. You have the people who are older than myself and my generation, which grew up in this very like kind of car dependent society, not just car dependent, but our status was based around the automobile. And if we had an automobile and a car really was about who we were. And I really believe that the 20 something and even the 30 somethings that are living in this community today, I think a car is less important to them. That mobility is about a cell phone or an iPad. It's not about, you know, having a, having a car. So they think about life in a different way. And so they're looking to be in a city that's more bike friendly, pedestrian friendly, and all that. But at the same point in time, we have this other generation of people that are still here that are still in more auto focus. So we're going to have to figure out how to transition from where we are today to a more transit friendly and bicycle and pedestrian friendly community. But in the process of that, it's going to be difficult because we have, I think, you know, huge needs. And I don't know if I really answered your question exactly, but
so it's difficult. And what kind of solutions? There's actually a lot of ideas out there about parking. I'm just curious if you have thought about that very much.
Well, I'll tell you one thing is that I don't think that in the uptown area, especially, you hear people talking about there not being enough parking. And then what happens is that also the people that live close to uptown feel that the parking moving into their neighborhoods. And what we've done in some places, they will create permitted streets,
sure,
to allow residents so they can park there, and then that gives the residents the ability, and it keeps the, you know, people that are coming just to shop from parking on their blocks. But what results in this, from my experience of talking to people, is those people who didn't want to pay to park and begin with, they just now move a block farther down. So it now just impacts the next block.
That's true.
So what I would like to see is maybe more of an easy bus comparison to parking. And you know what I'm talking about? So the bus system that, and I think it's Easy Bus, the bus that goes from like Chicago to Minneapolis, Megabus has like, you know, you can order a bus ticket online and get it for whatever, $7 to Chicago, and then the prices go up as the bus gets fuller. Mm-hmm. That's how it works. And I think that we should have more visible signs of the parking, the paid parking that is available, that's in kind of a Megabus type system that is in the Hennepin Lake and Lindale neighborhoods, and even in the along the Nicollet corridor, that say, here's where there is parking, and change the prices based on the availability. So that we're telling people where there is parking, and then the prices will change based on that, and hopefully drive the people that are trying to park to that. I mean, long term, my goal is to get people out of cars and into public transit and to be using alternative modes. But the reality is the far majority of people are not doing that. Mm. So, I mean, that's just the struggle.
Well, one of the reasons is, and I think about Hennepin Avenue is particularly bad. You were talking about the bus system not being that good. And mm-hmm. sometimes you could walk faster than the number 6 bus goes down, yeah, Hennepin.
Well, I think what I want on Hennepin, I'd like to have enhanced bus. So ideally, this is what we see in our corridor. Streetcars in Nicollet, which will be faster to get us up into downtown. On Hennepin Avenue, I'd like to have enhanced bus, which is, you know, similar to streetcars. It has limited stops. It has multiple doors that open so people can get in and off the bus quicker, and it's more like a light rail type station in the sense that it's the doors are level to the ground. And then they have the same ability to change the lights, which is what streetcars will have, that's helped them speed up. And so I'd like to see enhanced bus on Hennepin, streetcars on Nicollet, and then I'm pretty sure that we are going to, in the Midtown Greenway, we will either see streetcars or light rail. And the reason I'm more optimistic to one of those two being an option that we'll see is that the Metropolitan Council has now put that on their priority list of things that they want to work on. For a long time, the city has been trying to bolster that and saying, what can we do? And they're the ones kind of advocating.
Yeah, years ago I was at Midtown Greenway streetcar presentations, mm-hmm. and I thought it was intriguing.
But at the time, the Metropolitan Council didn't care.
Yeah.
Because we didn't have a governor that cared.
Yeah.
And now we have a governor that cares, and we have a Metropolitan Council that cares, and they're actually working to make it happen. So I think that I'm optimistic those pieces. So east-west, it's the Midtown Greenway, and then maybe even enhanced bus on Lake Street I could see as well.
Tell me about dedicated right-of-way and those enhanced bus systems. Do you have a thought about that?
I think that it's, you know, that's challenging. I mean, from a sense of logistically trying to figure out how to do it with all the other pieces.
Yeah, it sure is, you know.
Those are the challenges to figuring it out. And that's what makes it even hard on Hennepin Avenue. I would assume to do it, we're going to have to, I think we would have to get rid of some parking, probably.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably what we're going to have to do. So, but I think we have to think about, is the city built around the automobile, or is the city built around people? And I think if we think, well, what's best for people, we're going to say it's not built around the automobile. Mm-hmm. And so we have to figure out, how do we change that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so. I have these thoughts in my head every time I walk up and down Hennepin or Lindale. I really like the experience of the open streets on Lindale Avenue the last mm-hmm. couple of years, because it the character of the street changed so much just for that few hours. All of a sudden, just walking through, you know, the corner of Lindale and Lake, for example, it felt so different. Just being in a city felt different, because you weren't kind of fighting traffic the whole time that you were there, and people were coming out onto the mm-hmm. street. And just, it's kind of, it opens my mind to the possibilities for how our kind of cities can change.
Well, and I think that we should not dream small. What happens is we just become accepting, like, okay, here's how things are, this is the way they're always going to be. And I think that it's time for not only political leaders, but I think it's more important for people to really push politicians to think much bigger than they're thinking. I think that's the only way we're going to really solve these problems. And I actually love open streets. I think it's a, it's a, you know, fun and an interesting way to kind of like promote the idea of, hey, yeah, what is it like without the automobile? And I think it's a, you know, it's a good model for giving us that idea. I mean, at some point in time, I would love to figure out, there has to be some streets in the city of Minneapolis that, you know, maybe the streets themselves can be open streets all the time. Like, you know, I could probably lose votes over this, but, you know, what if DuPont, which is the street I live on, that it's only for bicycle and pedestrian folks from,
well, yeah.
here, you know, from here to downtown.
Or even just, I biked here from downtown on mm-hmm. to get here up Bryant. It's a bike boulevard. Yeah. But it's not a good Portland-style bike boulevard, mm-hmm. because what they have in Portland are a lot of diverters that kind of keep through traffic from going on the street. You can still drive to your house into your driveway mm-hmm. and get from that street to a more kind of main arterial mm-hmm. or connector street. But they kind of keep people from going through traffic on there.
And that
makes a big difference if you're on a bicycle.
And the safety issue with both the automobile and the individuals and bicycles is kind of critical. And what I think what we really need is, if I'm elected to city council, I'm already advocating for this, I think that we should be asking for at least 40 miles of cycle tracks between now and 2023. And some people probably say that's a lot, and, you know, and I'm sure you understand what I'm saying. I'm saying cycle tracks, but
yeah.
The dedicated lanes is what we need, which is what a lot of the other cities that have kind of have good bicycle infrastructure have. And I think that Minneapolis, we have some goals for getting more bicycle usage. I think to get to that next layer where you're going to get people to do it, it's the safety issue is the big issue. And so people don't feel safe. And those cycle tracks will make people feel more safe. In a lot of ways, it'll make drivers feel safe.
Well, yeah, you have to be more attentive, not just feel safe in a car. Actually, the ironic thing about that is it'll make drivers feel less safe, which will make them more safe because they'll be a little bit more nervous about the intersection and they won't just plow through it and maybe hurt somebody trying to cross the street. So, yeah, there's a tension about safety in cars, but I find a lot of these traffic calming measures improve safety for everybody, not just person crossing the street.
If you're a car and you hit a bicycle...
Yeah, it's not really...
It's not going to be good for you either.
No.
So it's so cycle tracks I know would help with some of that, and I think we need, we should be pushing for more and more. What happens is people say, well, don't we already have a lot? Because we have, I want to say it's 160 miles of bicycle lanes in the city of Minneapolis, you know, dedicated trails, street lanes, all of those types of things. And the fact is, no one will tell you, if you ask the city how many miles of roads we have, they don't know exactly. I mean, if you ask somebody, just ask them off the top of your head, you ask a city person, say, how many miles of road? They'll say, I don't know. I've asked all the time. But people can tell you how many miles of bike lane we have. Whatever we have in bike lanes are minimal in the amount of road infrastructure we have. I'm sure we have hundreds or thousands of miles of roads in the city. I mean, when you aggregate it all together. So whatever those that final number is, it makes what we have bicycle-wise, insignificant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the big hot issues in Ward 10 is density, especially right near where you live here on that kind of Hennepin and Lake sort of area. There's been a lot of new developments, and people get very animated, I should say, about how big those are going to be. So what are your thoughts about that? Say, like, the project that's just going up by the Greenway.
First, I think that we need density. But again, I had talked about this earlier. If we're going to build density, we should be building buildings that have the highest energy efficiency standards and buildings that are going to stand the test of time. And when I mean stand the test of time, they're like quality buildings. We're building using really good construction methods and high-quality development so that they're going to last forever. You can see cheap buildings when they're built. I mean, that were built 20 or 30 years ago. You say, well, it's kind of a cheap building.
It wasn't like built. Do you have an idea?
I think most people, if you just drive down the street and kind of look at a building versus you can see a building from 100 years ago and not that it doesn't need, there aren't things that need to improve in it. You'll say, well, that's a pretty beautiful building. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there were buildings that were built 100 years ago that don't exist anymore that weren't beautiful buildings. But my feeling is if you're going to build in these important corridors, let's build high quality. I'm not completely convinced everything built in our corridors along the Greenway are the highest quality. I think that some of it is and some of it could be higher quality.
But how high should the building be?
Well, I think that, what the small area plan says for that corridor is anywhere from 3 to 6 stories tall. So I think that that's it. In my opinion, most of the time, 6 stories is not a bad bet to go. But there are reasons that, that we can think of otherwise doing that. There are exceptions to that rule, but I don't, in general, more density within the corridor, I think is better. But the question is, here's what we're struggling with right now. We still have inferior public transportation, but we're building density. So the transportation thing is really critical because we're building density as though we have quality transportation, but we don't. And so that's creating the additional tension where we're not getting people out of their cars to be able to move away from that. So we really have to get to the point where we have higher quality public transportation so people can say, oh, I don't need a car. I mean, I was at a meeting today with really an older woman who I know very well who says, I'd love to get rid of my car, but Kenny, I can't spend 3 hours going from here to there to here. It just takes too long. So people want to use public transportation, but it has to be efficient. Mm-hmm. And that's, we don't have efficient, in the uptown corridor, it's inefficient. The fastest public transportation we have are express buses going to the University of Minnesota.
Those are really great. I know a lot of people live around here that take those. The 114, the 113.
It's easier. You can get to the University of Minnesota quicker from the uptown neighborhood than you can get to downtown. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just the reality. But those are kind of, in a way, they're kind of in a version of enhanced bus without the ability to change the lights. They have limited stops and all of those things like an enhanced bus. So That's what we're struggling with right now. The transportation infrastructure, the getting streetcars and enhanced bus and all those things, that has to be a higher priority than it is, so that we can accommodate that development. But right now, we're doing the density development as though we have a good backbone.
Yeah, well, it is a chicken and egg thing in a sense, right? You know, you're kind of hoping that you can't build the transportation infrastructure without the development either, right? So you can, and the transit-oriented development tries to do that, but...
Well, I'd actually say that in an ideal world, and actually, you know, Thomas Lowry, who built our streetcar system, it was all based on that premise.
Yeah, sure.
And I would say that in an ideal world, the easiest place to build public transportation is in an undeveloped area.
Yeah, well, I'm not saying you can't do it. I'm just saying it's politically difficult, right, sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't have the density to ask people to pay for a line through somewhere, that, you know.
But I still go back to the fact is it densities, is it the people living in that corridor's responsibility to pay for that? If it's their responsibility for them to pay for the transit, then are we making the same expectations of people using highways? That they should be paying an extra tax.
Mm-hmm.
So what about the people who drive 20, 25 miles? In my opinion, why shouldn't they be paying more taxes than someone who works at home or drives 2 miles?
I mean, takes the bus to work.
Yeah, or takes the bus to work. Why do... Because we have to pay for that infrastructure for them. All of us in society are paying for that. It costs money to maintain that, to upkeep all of that. And so that's a cost. I mean, keeping our current road system is a very, very expensive ongoing obligation for government. And but we think of transit different as, oh, as though it's a special
those
thing.
People.
And those people should pay for, you know.
Anytime you say those people, you're already in trouble.
Yeah, but I think it's viewed that way. Like, well, we're building this and, you know, you got to build the development so the people in the development can help pay for the, you know, transit.
Yeah.
So,
I couldn't resist asking you about your comedy background. It's one of the details on your CV. And here's the question. Can you tell me about that? And then did Al Franken open the door for you to be kind of,
The only thing Al Franken and I have in common is that we both grew up in St. Louis Park and we both drank water that had creosote in it.
Because
when we were kids in St. Louis Park, our water system was contaminated with creosote. And so we were
both. Is that pretty good?
I don't know. I ended up with colon cancer at 39, so I don't know if I'm blaming
I guess I shouldn't joke about it.
No, I'm just, I don't know if the creosote's to blame, but if I can figure out a way to blame it, I will. Me and Al have no direct connection, but...
You both kind of think about, you're trying to be in politics.
And I will say that the other thing I want to say is Al Franken was a much more successful comedian and made significantly more money than I did.
Yes, okay.
So he... I was in stand-up and I did perform and I worked with a lot of great folks over the years from, you know, Louis Anderson to Tom Arnold to Roseanne Barr to Bill Maher, and I did multiple shows together and on folks that people would know today. It was an important part of my life, but it was just a part of my life. Mm-hmm. And so there's...
Kind of a hobby?
Well, no, I made my living doing it.
Okay.
When I did it. And it paid my bills. I mean, I was a bohemian. I was a 20-something bohemian, but it paid my bills. I wasn't, and I rode the bus back then too.
Yeah.
And so, so I've been using public transportation, the majority of my life. And I will say that if I'm elected to the city council, I will either bike, walk, or bus to work each day. Mark my words on this. I will post on Facebook or Twitter which bus I'm on, and I will look forward to impromptu meetings with constituents.
That's great. That's like a Mayor Bloomberg was kind of famous for, I think he only did it symbolically a number of times, but for riding the subway to work through New York City. And I'm just amazed that there aren't very many people that do that.
We have some council members that do, but the far majority of them drive their car. I will tell you that I think it's one of the reasons that we have a crappy public transportation system. We don't have people, we have council members that their car is still their main way of thinking as well. And I'm not blaming them because that's where they are. But, you know, I've got my my well-worn bus card in my pocket, and I've used public transportation the majority of my life. And we need people that are going to advocate for that, the city. But I don't know if I ever answered your Comedy Central question.
Well,
I dodged it. I got really in trans back in transit. See, that's how I care more about transit than I do about comedy.
It's not a laughing matter, yeah. Transit.
But you know, I did have a transit joke back when I did.
I've got a bicycle joke for you too. Let's exchange those.
Okay, you give me your bicycle joke first.
Oh well, I got two of them. The first one's really bad. Okay. So what do you call why did the bicycle go to bed early?
I don't know.
Because it was too tired. Okay. But then here's another one. It's kind of terrible. Well, it's not terrible. There's this bar, you know, how does it start? This road walks into a bar. It's a 2-lane road. Okay. He sits down and orders a drink and he says, I'm the toughest road in here. And you know, all the other potholes in the bar are like, whoa, that's a bad road. You know, don't mess with that road. And then, it's sitting there and having its drink and kind of feeling good about itself. And then this 4-lane road with the like median in the middle walks into the bar and sits down and says, I'm the baddest road in here. And the 2-lane road kind of like goes all pale and concrete and like goes and hides in the booth, you know? And then this interstate highway, you know, with all these divided overpasses and, it walks into the bar, sits down and says, I'll take anyone on and show them who's boss. And the 4-lane road and the 2-lane road, they just like run out the back door, you know. And then this little tiny piece of concrete with weeds coming out, it's crumbling. It's only like 5 feet wide. It walks in and sits down and says, I'm the baddest road in here, right? And the interstate, like, goes all chalky and, you know, it like runs away and it goes quaking and this pothole is talking to this other pothole and it's like, how come everyone's afraid of that tiny little piece of nothing? And the other pothole says, well, that's because that's a psychopath. And it's crazy. That's the joke I'm working on.
It's good. It's psychopath.
You're professional. I feel bad about it.
I didn't even know my joke's going to be good because, you know, I was a punker comic back in my day. My hair stood up straight. I was, my performance sheet said, my head was in a pot. My hair was all ratted up, kind of like the guy from The Cure.
Oh, yeah?
And my head was in a pot, in my planet pot. And I had a real one. Because actually people would say, hey, so did you Photoshop that in? And I was like, no, we didn't have Photoshop back in the 80s.
Do your opponents have these photos? I'm curious.
No, I don't really care if they do. And plants were growing around it. And then it had a little like tag in it that instead of like saying, you know, those tags will say like tomatoes or what the vegetable is. My tag said comedian and my head is in it. My mom said it used to spook her out, that photo. But underneath it, my promo sheet that had this photo on it said, Ken Bradley, genetic engineering at its best. But that was my promo sheet. But my transit, what was my transit related joke? Oh, so anyways, I was giving this to you to understand that I was kind of, you know, I was somewhat of a character as a comic. So it was me, but it wasn't me, you know.
Yeah.
It's kind of
in the Andy Kaufman kind of,
in a way, spirit. Yeah. It was a, you know, it was an alter ego part of me, you know, and so I had this. And this is the joke. Do you think it's true that a man's car is an extension to his penis? Mm-hmm. Well, if it is true, a man who drives a Corvette must be quick. A man who drives a Prius must be small but efficient. And myself, I ride the bus. And that was the joke.
It's funny.
Yeah, it worked really well in a club. I felt like it didn't work so well with you. I don't know if I want one. The thing was, it had like a lot of, as a punchline, it has like, you can write your own.
Yeah.
You can write your own definition. See,
that's the kind of joke that makes you think.
Well, because, and truthfully, I can write three different, what does that mean? What does he mean by that?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I go, yeah. You know, who knows what I mean by it?
Yeah.
So, pick up your transfers after the show.
Huh. So. That's funny.
It's all right. It was a joke.
My joke sucks too. I'm about to tell you right now.
You know,
it's a bicycle joke.
Well, and listen, I wrote this stuff back in the 80s. Do you remember anything from the 80s that was good?
I was very small.
So, how old were you?
I'm 33.
33? Yeah. So just so you know, anything in the 80s, there'll never be a time when people will think
Eddie Murphy was really good.
The only thing good in the 80s was Minneapolis music.
Yeah.
The Replacements, the Jayhawks, Husker Du, before Soul Asylum got weird. You know, not that they were weird, but they became poppier. In the early days, they were originally, I think, called Louder Faster. I can't remember there. You know, there are a lot of great Minneapolis bands back in those days So it was great music. And then most of those bands, you could go see them somewhere in this neighborhood at someone's house party.
Oh, yeah.
Like, hey, we're going to this, you know, some of the great bands of Minneapolis were playing in people's garages or basements.
Do you think that spirit's still alive?
Yeah, I think there's musicians, but the problem is the music industry has changed dramatically. And,
yeah.
And I don't know, truthfully, I don't think our city actually prioritizes the arts enough, mm-hmm. in the sense that I actually think that the arts provides a lot more benefits to our city than sports do. If you really look at per capita, we have more theater seats in Minneapolis than New York City does. We have tons of great little art galleries. We have a lot of people who are doing really unique creative art in our city. And the arts are treated, you know, as not just a second, but like a third class citizen when mm-hmm. you think about it. But the fact is the economic development around the arts is significant. And I know we already heard in our interview, but if you look at Lynn Lake, what revitalized Lynn Lake was two primary things. First was the Bryant Lake Bowlin Theater coming in Lake Street in the early 1990s, and they had a theater there. So, it was restaurant, bar, and bowling, but the theater was a part of it. And then it was the Jungle Theater, which is first on Lake Street, and then it moved to Lindale. Those two establishments were the anchor that all the other development happened around. Mm-hmm. After that, more things popped up. And so what people don't get is that arts are all about, you know, arts really help to revitalize and create stability in the neighborhood. And any developer will tell you, first the artists come.
Yeah, sure.
And then after that...
It's a cliche, but it's true.
No, it's totally true. And yeah. Right now where that's happening is artists don't live in Uptown anymore. Some of them live in Whittier.
Yeah.
But they don't live in Uptown anymore. They live in either Whittier or they live in Northeast Minneapolis. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so if you want to know where the next things are happening...
Or across the freeway from here, and there's a couple other neighborhoods too. But so I guess the last thing was like, what is next on your campaign? What are you working on right now? Like, what do we do? What are you doing?
What am I doing
this week?
What am I doing this week? Wow. Well, we're doing tons of things. We've got a debate coming up on March 12th at the First Universalist Church on 34th and DuPont. You can sign up on my website for Coffee with Ken, which are also turning into Beer with Bradley. We've done three Coffee with Kens already. We have...
Are those two different people?
What?
Are those two different people?
What do you mean?
I'm just joking.
Go Coffee with Ken or Beer with Bradley? Yeah. No, same person. I originally said I'm going to do Coffee with Ken, and someone said, I want to do Beer with Bradley. I was like, all right, okay. We'll do it. So we're doing Coffee with Kens, and we're doing Beer with Bradley. We have two Beer with Bradleys coming up, and if people email me at ken@kenfor10.org or go to my website and contact me, which is www.kenfor10.org, kenfortn.org, we will let them know about it. But we've got artists and musicians playing at the one coming up on March 7th. And then we're doing one on the 21st at the Bryant Lake Bowl.
Okay. So. Great. Well, that's it. Thanks, Ken.
All right. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks for listening to the Streets.mn podcast. If you have any feedback or ideas, you can comment on Streets.mn on Twitter @StreetsMN or email me at blindeke@gmail.com. So long from Uptown in Minneapolis.